You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Michael.
Hello, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show. You're Michael Tracy, highly controversial journalist. Is that fair to say?
Gee, I had no idea. That's very shocking that you
would. This is news to you? Well, let me explain to you how I know this, then. I should present you with the evidence. In the most recent issue of Vanity Fair, in fact, the physical magazine, no less, you are mentioned as part of a nefarious group identified as the alt-left. This is a piece by James Walcott, and he says there's a thing called the alt-left. He names names. You are one of the names. I want to talk about that, whether there is such a thing as the alt-left, whether you indeed are part of it, or whether you disavow any association. Are you now, or have you ever been, a member of the alt-left is what we're going to find out. But I want to get into that by way of talking about the whole Russia and Trump thing, because that's very closely connected to what the alt-left is, your view on that. So we'll start out with that, move into the alt-left. But first, let's say a little more about you. You've just made a big career move, right? You've joined up with the Young Turks.
I have. The Young Turks is a what I would maybe describe as a new media outfit. It's gained a fair amount of prominence, I would say, in the last year or two, especially over the course of the 2016 election. It describes itself as the most watched online news program. It's primarily on YouTube. I've joined to do all manner of things, reporting, commentary, etc.
Yeah, and actually it's been around a while. I was in its Southern California studios in 2009 promoting a book. I was interviewed on the Young Turks, and it really I think you're right. It's had a surge of prominence recently, but it was pretty prominent quite a while ago because they were early to see the potential of YouTube. The founder, whose name I would surely mispronounce, although I can spell it, the first name is C-E-N-K. How do you pronounce
Cenk.
The whole... Cenk.
Cenk Uygur.
Uygur. Who is of Turkish descent, presumably, hence the name.
Yes.
But he was he's a real visionary. I mean, he was, as I said, he was early to get the picture. They do have a very big following on YouTube. And they have an interesting approach to hiring people. They actually, crowdsource the fundraising when they want to hire somebody.
Right. That's how I was hired. Yeah. I hadn't even been aware that they were doing this crowdsourcing effort, but apparently my name came up enough that they saw fit to offer me a position.
Is that how it happened? I was thinking that they raised the money just for the position generically, not letting...
That's what they did. Yeah,
they raised. That's what they did. But some of the people donating money suggested you. Is that what happened?
That's what I gather happened. You know, some people internally had been aware of me, and they sensed that the people who were giving money and who were in the Young Turk sort of orbit, you know, had this burning desire for me to be hired. So that's you know roughly what happened. And they're trying to expand now into more firsthand journalism. For most of its existence, the Young Turks has been just a commentary show, reportage here and there. But the point of the fundraising was to try to jump a little more wholly into doing actual reporting on the ground oriented stuff.
Right. It's kind of, as I recall, kind of like a TV news show with a slant, with overt commentary, but not just commentary, right? I mean, all along there's been that kind of... it's been a little like a nightly, you know, network news show, except they have more of an angle.
Right. And, you know, my work hasn't been principally for the main show. There's another channel that they started a little over a year ago called TYT Politics, where contributors who have some semblance of independence sort of do their own reporting and commentary, and then every once in a while that is used or excerpts are taken from that for the main show. But me and the two other people who are now working under the auspices of TYT Politics basically have a mandate to independently pursue what it is we want to pursue with the resources and backing of the Young Turks institutionally.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how would you characterize the Young Turks' ideology? I mean, they're thought of as generally progressive, but there's something non-mainstream about them, right?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think you would probably get different answers from different people. Probably anti-establishmentarian, progressive. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't impose any kind of ideological litmus test on me. Mm-hmm. I tend to not be too thrilled about the moniker progressive, just because it's so diluted, I feel, and it's often can be cheap. I remember during the 2016 Democratic primary, there was like a week or two where the big debate was who could be more rightly described as a progressive. You know, what that means in practice, I'm not necessarily sure most of the time. But yeah, I think a lot of people there would self-identify as progressive, and that's perfectly fine with me.
Yeah. Okay, so let's do wind our way back to this question of the alt-left and why you're controversial and why you have so many haters on Twitter. In fact, only today, hours ago, I opened Twitter and you had just tweeted, reiterating my open invitation to Twitter trolls constantly peddling falsehoods about my views to engage me directly via live YouTube chat.
Rick.
You have any tips?
Yeah, I did that because, you know, similarly to what we're doing now, often misconceptions about one's views can be hashed out over the course of a longer form discussion when you're actually facing your adversary, even though we're doing it through a computer right now. And I feel like a lot of the misconceptions that I see swirling having to do with me are just not grounded in reality. They tend to be the product of this sort of Twitter culture that coalesces around almost a social signaling and this impulse to be part of an in-group. And often the in-group is identified with certain memes and jokes and, you know, kind of running themes that end up emerging. And I just don't recognize a lot of the criticisms that I see leveled at me. So I've always offered, and I've both publicly and privately, for hey, if you have a grievance with me, if you have a legitimate problem with anything I've advocated or a position I've taken, let's discuss it, and let's see what the actual source of the disagreement is there, rather than just engaging in this petty sniping that is really one of the preeminent features of Twitter, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So as for the Russia thing, which I think is one reason you have some haters, some progressive haters on Twitter, what is your view on this whole Russia and Trump thing that seems to antagonize people?
Well, I would be reluctant to speak on behalf of my antagonists, but you know, from my vantage point, I think the main thing to emphasize here is that the evidentiary basis for the claims that are now so flippantly made about this supposed collusion between Trump and Russia is still remarkably flimsy. The main presentation of evidence, you'll remember, was this Director of National Intelligence report that was put out in early January when Obama was still in office. And it was roundly mocked, even by people who were desperately craving verification of the theories regarding Trump and Russia that they had been pushing for so long. Half the report was devoted to like years-old complaints about Russia Today, this obscure TV network that has very minimal influence on anything of import. And then the actual substance of the claims that were made regarding Russian quote-unquote interference were based on just surmises. They weren't based on anything that was straightforwardly factual, and at the very least, nowhere near enough to be certain as to, you know, the factual reality of the supposed quote-unquote interference. And the notion of interference to me is sort of weird in its own right, because how did Russia quote-unquote interfere? Allegedly, what they did was they provided information to the American public about the workings of extremely powerful political officials. So the American people got things like, say, the Hillary Clinton speech transcripts that were repressed. Remember, there was a big bone of contention during the Democratic primary that she wouldn't release her speech transcripts to hated banks like Goldman Sachs. And Hillary had said that she would look into, quote-unquote, releasing those, and she never did, and they only came out as a result of this, quote-unquote, Russian hacking. So, you know, people got more information that it was their right to view as a result of the supposed nefarious interference. And I think that aspect of it is totally missing. And then you have the evidentiary, the dearth of valid evidentiary basis for the grandiose claims that are made. And then thirdly, and this is something that I've experienced in person now doing reporting, you have the most activated core of the Democratic Party's base. So people who are showing up to town hall meetings, who have founded these new groups over social media to caused a sort of ruckus at Republican town halls and even some Democratic town halls. The issue foremost on their minds, and this is a trend I've observed in person repeatedly now, is Russia. And they're propagating these really fanciful notions of what the supposed collusion entailed. They're exhibiting a really discernible paranoid streak where they're basically attributing to Putin these omniscient qualities as if he is somehow single-handedly devising events the world over. And to me, kind of promoting that style of belief has destructive ramifications, even if it may result in some short-term political consternation for Trump and maybe even weaken his ability to govern effectively. So that's an encapsulation of why this stuff has.
So that leads to an interesting question. I mean, you know, what are these destructive ramifications? Because I think part of the blowback you're getting is because, you know, a lot of people say the kinds of things you're saying. It's just that most of them are Trump supporters. Generally speaking, people who are motivated to minimize the Russia thing are people who are Trump supporters, and so I think there's a kind of suspicion arises in the minds of your detractors when you, although you identify as basically on the left, when you start seeming to minimize the scandal. And I was about to ask you, and what you said leads into the answer, would you say you are just a stickler for objectivity and truth, or are there specific destructive things you envision here, and would they be of the left of liberals getting too caught up in this narrative, and is it that they are destructive, you know, of they hurt the nation, or do they hurt ultimately the left and ultimately help Trump, or what? Kind of sketch those out.
Yeah, I think the climate that's being fostered is destructive on a number of levels. First, you mentioned that anybody who raises suspicions or is consistently skeptical about this prevailing narrative regarding Trump and Russia is immediately cast as some kind of Trump apologist. I can't tell you how often I field that accusation, which has no merit as far as I'm concerned, but people are convinced that it's true. So just think about what that means. It means that people questioning hysteria regarding an adversarial nuclear armed power can immediately expect to be basically slandered as the worst of the worst, because if you can be accused of a Trump supporter in certain circles in the United States, whether it's in academia or the media or so forth, that's almost a death sentence. So people have to be extremely circumspect about how they talk about this matter, because just reputationally, it could be a disaster for them for anything that they say to even be construed as somehow indicating support for Trump. So I think that alone is sort of an insidious effect of all this. It's sort of just a stifling effect that I think a lot of, you know, the current discussion is sort of mired with. And then in terms of, you know, fostering this kind of paranoia in elements of the electorate or of the populace, yeah, I think that is destructive on its own terms as well. You know, I hear often that people think, you know, the ends justify the means here, even if maybe some of this is a little overwrought, even if maybe this isn't the people who are promulgating this narrative don't have an entirely firm grasp on reality. It's still all justified because it'll have the effect of weakening Trump, maybe stymieing his governing agenda, and that'll make it more likely for Democrats to win maybe in 2018 or 2020. But my what I've always said in response to that is, so you're saying that the Democrats are unable to put forward a rational and truth-based critique of Trump that is sufficient to win over a critical mass of the electorate and get them on board with their governing program, and then, you know, counter Trump on those grounds? So to me, that's indicative of sort of a fundamental flaw within the liberal side of things. If they feel so moved to latch on to this narrative, it's as if they have no other kind of political critique on offer. And Doug Henwood, who's a left-wing commentator, put it, I think, exactly correctly. He said that the Democrats are using this Russia mania as a substitute for an actual political critique. And I think they are. You know, when you go to these town hall meetings, you know, the number one sign that's being waved now is Trump plus Russia equals treason, which sounds really, you know, scary and damning and salacious. So if that's what's on the menu, people are going to gravitate toward it, and they're not going to come up with a more holistic criticism that I think has that I think is likely to actually undermine Trump in a way that will produce something beneficial.
And there is a certain irony to the main mode of attack on Trump being to identify him with an allegedly insidious foreign influence, since, after all, that is, in my mind, about 70% of what's objectionable about him. I mean, that's what he does.
And the main criticism, like the function of this criticism, is to basically assert that Trump is insufficiently belligerent toward a certain power. Yeah. Like, is that the instinct that we want to encourage on Trump? Is he not belligerent enough? So the idea that you know, that's the main criticism coming from liberals is, I think, just unbelievably ironic.
I mean, at the same time, Russia has been a kind of a glaring exception. I mean, I share a certain amount of your reaction to this whole narrative, because it just seems like on a day-to-day basis, there's pretty consistent overreaction to what the latest news is seeming to damn Trump, even though I don't dismiss it all, and it's there's not nothing there. It's just that the psychology you see at work on the left is, in my mind, disturbingly similar to the psychology you saw in support of Trump in processing news, in processing allegations about Hillary Clinton and so on.
That's exactly true. And think back to 2009. So Republican elites, for the most part, didn't buy into this notion that Obama was some kind of Manchurian candidate trying to implement a stealth jihadist agenda. They didn't really buy that he his birth was illegitimate. But Republicans seeking to foster that instinct among the Republican base saw it as an opportunity to capitalize on a certain sentiment and to kind of channel that into political avenues to further their own ends. And it was maybe even arguably effective with respect to the 2010 midterm elections. I mean, Republicans won a historic victory, but it sort of did pretty lasting damage in the minds of just ordinary people, to the political system overall. So for that to be replicated, and I'm not asserting, you know, simple equivalency there, but it's sort of a similar tack that's being taken, I think, now. And the idea that it's going to be self-contained and it won't have any consequences beyond just undercutting Trump, I think, is naive. These things always have lasting implications. People aren't just going to suddenly forgive Putin, you know, if they think that he was the single most consequential force in electing, you know, somebody who they perceive to be a fascist who could take down the entire system of American governance. I mean, those are the terms that people perceive what's happening in. You know, the type of hyperbole that would have just been preposterous a year or two ago. So I think it's, you know, it's concerning on multiple levels.
Now, all this said, there is, as I said, there is something a little weird about the Russia thing with Trump. And, I mean, for example, at the convention, when he basically intervened in the formulation of the platform to make sure to change, I guess, an existing Republican position on arming Ukrainians, right? Generally speaking, when you do an intervention like that, is done in response to either like a vocal part of your constituency. I don't think that was the case here. Donors. We don't know who they would be because that doesn't seem to be high on the agenda of any of the donors that I can think of offhand, or like just heartfelt ideological conviction. And this, I mean, remember, is before like Bannon signed on, I think. So Paul Manafort. Well, there we get into interesting stuff because he has connections to Ukraine. But I will say, I think it remains an interesting question exactly what happened there, because that was not typical politics. And, you know, as you said, Trump is a generally belligerent guy. He was talking about China in belligerent terms. He talks about much of the world, Mexico, Iran in belligerent terms. So I think why the exception remains an interesting question, even if the supposedly damning evidence is, in my mind, less damning than it is said to be.
Well, that thing about the platform being amended at the Republican convention was sort of the genesis of a lot of this theorizing. There was a widely read post that Josh Marshall wrote in reaction to that, that just, you know, rocketed around the Twitter sphere and so forth, and just, you know, basically laid the groundwork for what people would then perceive to be this just unraveling conspiracy between Trump and Russia. And at the time, I wrote a post myself in reaction to Marshall's post and pointed out that the Trump sort of apparatus intervened in matters other than Ukraine in the platform drafting process that just weren't emphasized.
Like where?
So there were amendments that were made with respect to trade, where Trump does depart from Republican orthodoxy.
Yeah, but constituency is talking. That makes political sense.
Well, I mean, the point is Trump's team implemented amendments to the Republican platform that reflected where he departed from prevailing Republican orthodoxy.
Right, but I mean,
so trade was one example. They even amended it on something having to do with Israel, which you didn't hear mentioned at all.
What was the amendment?
I would have to go back.
Was it so-called pro-Israel or so-called anti-Israel?
It was pro-Israel. Pro-Israel.
Well, okay, but even there.
But the way it was framed at the time was, oh, Trump took no interest whatsoever in the platform drafting process other than this Ukraine thing, and that is suggestive of his nefarious intent. But, you know, there were other aspects of the platform that he took interest in.
Okay, but again, in my mind, the source of the puzzle is that in the other two examples you cite, there are explanations. I mean, one of his big donors is Sheldon Adelson, who is above all pro-Israel, he's not pro-Israel, I think. I think he's encouraging things that will lead to Israel's destruction, but he's pro-Likud. He is hardcore right pro-Israel. So that makes sense. The trade thing makes sense because Trump was mobilizing this base of, you know, blue-collar workers in the Rust Belt and so on who felt threatened by trade. So that'll make sense. The Russia thing, it does, it remains a little in need of an explanation. Now, I personally think there's actually what, to my mind, is a more alarming explanation in a way than the explanations commonly put forward, which are about, you know, corruption and Trump owing money to Russia or whatever, which is just that this, although Bannon wasn't with the campaign at this point, you know, the influence of Bannonism had been there for some time, and to some extent coincides with Trumpism as it existed then. And I think in Bannon's view, in his like ethno-nationalist view, Russia is a natural ally. It's a white Christian nation opposed to what he calls radical Islam. for that matter, Israel in a certain way makes sense. It's not Christian, but it's ethno-nationalist in a certain sense and ardently opposed to what he calls radicalism, so on. So that, I mean, one thing that bothers me about this is that kind of ideological explanation is getting almost no attention because people are looking for, like, you know, B-grade movie kinds of plot, you know, explanations here, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's probably some truth to what you had just outlined there, but now I'm thinking back to one of the first times that Trump actually mentioned Putin in a favorable light over the course of the 2016 campaign. It was when Russia intervened for the first time in Syria. And Trump went on, I think it was CNN, and he was asked for his, you know, for his thoughts on this. And he said something along the lines of, you know, in his typical sort of crude fashion, why do we need a problem? Let Russia take care of ISIS. I mean, why are we spending money on this if the, you know, ISIS is in their own backyard and they want to take a forceful approach? And Russia has long had an issue with jihadi insurgencies. They've been at the forefront of counterterrorism in the region. Remember, they partnered with George W. Bush just after 9/11 on that. To me, it makes sense, you know, beyond the ethno-nationalist explanation, which might be a factor. Trump's principal ideology is whether his deal-making prowess. So if he thought the United States could get a deal by Russia handling this ISIS thing rather than us getting bogged down on it and spending millions of dollars there or billions that could be better spent on, say, American infrastructure, and he was in favor of that. I mean, I think it's probably a multifaceted explanation, but to me, that one always was the most...
No, it's true that he had been, for some time, opposing gratuitous intervention and had been something of a foreign policy realist. So, and that's all, you know, kind of consistent with that that platform change. But, so it's... I don't know. But I agree that, you know, that things kind of tend to get overdone in the course of assessing all the latest evidence. And maybe we should just, before we get to the alt-left thing, talk a little about the latest stuff.
Well, just another point on the Russia on the way that this has been framed. Mm-hmm. I think there's an instinct, and this is probably transpartisan. So I don't know that I would characterize this as rooted in the left or right, but there's this, I think, impulse to make rather banal events a lot more exciting and salacious than they actually are, mm-hmm. because that kind of generates interest. It gets people immersed in what could almost resemble like a Hollywood thriller at this point, you know, espionage, foreign collusion. I mean, if you just kind of, the script on this is probably so outlandish that it would be rejected by a studio, at least the way that it's being framed by the most hysterical proponents. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's a factor here as well. I mean, you want to believe the worst possible thing about your enemy. So therefore, you'll develop confirmation bias, which leads to you interpreting every disparate fact or every disparate revelation as confirmation of your underlying belief that, you know, Trump is the worst possible person that could ever assume the presidency. And therefore, it makes perfect sense that he would be, you know, part of this outlandish conspiracy.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think you know that you see that instinct manifest all across the spectrum, and right now it's manifesting most starkly, I think, among the sort of center left.
Yeah. And I think we'll never know. I mean, the most interesting question to me is, well, was Russia saying to the campaign, you know, we're doing things to help you out. We can help you out. You know, was there knowledge of the hacking and on the part of the Trump administration and encouragement of it? That would be news. I just think we'll never know. And I don't think it's impossible, but I think we'll never know. I mean, as for the most recent developments, like the Jeff Sessions thing, I didn't think was all that damning for the following reason. I mean, on the one hand, I thought, oddly, some of the liberal press was kind of going easy on Sessions in a certain sense. And I thought maybe that suggested that Trump has been successful in kind of like you know, this like enemy, the media as enemy of the people campaign. Maybe he's made some of the liberal media a little more cautious, because the way they were reporting the Sessions thing, a lot of them, including NPR, was he had that Sessions had failed to disclose these things in his testimony. Well, no, it went further than that. He said, "I didn't have communications with Russians." Now, that said, I think, and it turned out he had. That said, I think if you're really objectively looking at exactly what he said, one thing that strikes you is he didn't have to talk about himself at all. They didn't say, have you had any communication? So if he was actually lying, if he was actually thinking, "I've had communications and I don't want them to know this," he just wouldn't start talking about himself at all, I think. And so I don't really... I think saying, you know, as some people did, that he lied, you know, like consciously deceived, I think is far from warranted.
Right. So Senator Al Franken didn't specifically ask, "Did you ever meet with the Russians?" Sessions volunteered that information in the context of a question that was specifically about a news report regarding Trump campaign contacts with Russian actors. So was Sessions inartful in the way he phrased that? Yeah, I would think so.
He was strictly speaking factually wrong. He said something that wasn't true. He said, "I did not have communications with Russians." That's false. But I think he had forgotten it was false. I think he was thinking of himself for whatever reason. I don't think he was aware. I don't think he recalled that meeting at the time. That's my guess. But he was factually wrong.
Right. I think, yeah, it's strictly speaking, it was factually wrong. Was it an intentional deception? I tend to be doubtful of that. I mean, I think people tend to portray sloppiness or ineptitude or just general incompetence as evidence of some kind of sinister plot, when in reality, like I mentioned earlier, the explanation is usually just more banal than that. It's just kind of, Sessions wasn't fully cognizant of the expectation that was going to be, you know, put upon him to be 100% absolutely clear about the extent of his contact with Russians. And you know, there's a great Vanity Fair piece that just came out, not the one that we'll be talking about later, but that kind of went through these varying explanations for Sessions' conduct and concludes that, yeah, this was probably another example of people getting ahead of themselves and thinking that they finally found the smoking gun evidence of some kind of conspiracy between Trump and Russia. And they didn't take 2 seconds to just sort of contextualize it and, apply Occam's razor and think, you know, what actually happened here. So that's an impulse that you see on display constantly, and it's just getting tiresome at this point.
Now, one more recent development before we turn to the alt-left, which I promise we will do.
More
it's interesting to me because it's a very interesting question, I definitely want to talk about it. Because Walcott, in constructing this alt-left thing, included people ranging from Glenn Greenwald to Mickey Kouse, and I think it's at that point you start wondering how much coherence is there to this alt-left thing. But we will get to that. I first wanted to say, there's a kind of a connection, apparently, between the whole Russia thing and the most recent news as we speak, which is Trump accusing Obama of having wiretapped him, having tapped his phone. It's this. Now, tell me, you've probably been paying more closer attention to this than I have, but yesterday I read this piece on Empty Wheel that's by Marcy Wheeler, right? Is that
right.
And it was a pretty well-researched and detailed analysis of everything, of what the basis for Trump's claim might be. And my sense is that, my guess, having read that, is that, okay, he's wrong about the phone tap. There was no phone tap. He's wrong to say there was any tap of Trump Tower per se, but it may have been the case that there was a FISA the FISA court approved the monitoring of a computer that I guess maybe was somewhere in the Trump organization, because the computer was having a whole lot of communication with computers in Russia. And I assume this is the same thing that Frank Foer wrote about in Slate, right? And it turned out, so Frank was, you know, made it all sound very nefarious, all these computers back and forth. And then there was a seemingly knowledgeable rebuttal by some guys at The Intercept.
And by the way, Hillary Clinton's Twitter account tweeted out that Foer story.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, a lot of people did. And if you read the story, you know, it seemed like, whoa. But The Intercept rebuttal seemed very well informed. And what they basically said is, look, what was most likely going on here was just spam. It was, I forget whether the Russians were sending the spam or the Trump Hotel was sending the spam, but there was just a feedback loop of spam. But anyway, my sense is that, and that computer, I think, was not a Trump Tower. It was not a phone. It was not Trump's phone. It was not any of the things that Trump is saying. But is it your sense that that's actually what may be at the bottom of Trump's accusation?
You know, that's plausible. I don't know with enough certainty to say either way. I think there are a lot of moving parts here that people have a hard time getting a full handle on. I would note a very interesting tweet that was issued by Jon Favreau, who was the speechwriter for Obama and is now just sort of like a media personality who people love to adulate. And he says, quote, "I'd be careful about reporting that Obama said there was no wiretapping. Statement just said that neither he nor the White House ordered it." So he's leaving open the possibility that there was, in fact, some wiretapping that may have happened. Where Trump erred, which is not surprising, is that he seemed to attribute the wiretapping, or the alleged wiretapping, to a direct order that was handed down personally by Barack Obama, which probably is not how it would have come about.
I predict that Trump's error will be shown to go way beyond that. Trump said his phone was tapped. I'll bet you anything that's wrong. And he's been saying it was about something, that Trump Tower was tapped. And I think that will be proved wrong, you know, because what's his name? Clapper, who was the head of what? He was the director of national intelligence. He was today asked, you know, he said any FISA order would have had to come over my desk. I would have seen it. And he said, I forget exactly, I think he denied both the Trump phone tap and any Trump Tower thing. He said, no, I would have seen that. It did not happen. I think all that happened was there was a computer, maybe somewhere in the Trump organization, that, and basically we've already read about that. It's Frank Foer's piece. I think that's what's actually at the bottom of this. So I think there was a FISA request, and there was in some sense a wiretap, but it wasn't about Trump Tower or Trump's phone. And you're right, Obama did not personally direct it. In fact, we've seen that Obama keeps, some would say, takes a disturbingly hands-off approach to the FBI, because they did not intervene when Comey said, I'm going to put out this letter that was damaging to Hillary Clinton. His boss, the attorney general, didn't stop him, right? So,
yeah, there was a good piece in Just Security, which is a blog by Julian Sanchez, who has followed this meticulously. And I would just defer to that in terms of the factual, you know, chronological, you know, detail here.
Yeah, okay.
Far be it for me to get inside Trump's head about what he actually meant.
So as for the alt-left, now is there's some degree of coherence here, because you and Glenn Greenwald, for example, have been largely on the same page about the Russian thing. I mean, I think Glenn has made the point, you know, in other words, in being cautionary about how much we know and being critical of people on the left who go beyond what we know. And one of the ironies Glenn, I think, has pointed to is that one of the concerns motivating some things he said is the concern that, look, the deep state, as well, whatever you want to call it, but the establishment, kind of the intelligence gathering establishment, is something we don't want getting into politics. In the past, it's gotten into politics in a way that people on the left definitely didn't like. And some of the information feeding the Russian thing seems to have come, you know, from via leaks from that establishment. And so a proper leftist, a principled leftist, should be concerned about that and so on. So there are, but in any event, you and Glenn have kind of been on the same page here, right? So that's two people who James Walcott mentioned in this alt-left piece who seem to have something in common, right?
Yeah. Like I mentioned in an email to you, the inclusion of Mickey Kaus kind of just rendered the entire thing basically.
I gotta say, that was so weird. I mean,
that seems like it was like grinding an old axe or something rather than any kind
of. Well, Walcott has been known to do that. He goes way back before you were born, probably. How old are you?
28.
Okay, so I remember him from like the late 80s. And, you know, he's known as a very good eviscerator, he's very good at skewing things. He's a stylist. He's not known as a particularly cogent analyst. And including Mickey Kaus and with Glenn Greene. I mean, you know, the accusation I've made against Mickey is he should quit calling himself a liberal because he's a conservative. It's not that complicated. So I agree with you that the overall analytical framework is lacking here. But what about some other names? Okay, so like Freddie DeBoer, who, you know, he mentions, Walcott mentions publications like Jacobin, Truthdig, Consortium News, which I'm not too familiar with, Naked Capitalism, mentions you, Michael Tracy, Freddie DeBoer, Mark Ames, Connor Kilpatrick, I'm not aware of all them, Jeremy Scahill, I'm very aware of.
Connor Kilpatrick is an editor at Jacobin.
Okay. So is there, do you see yourself as, to some extent, part of a discernible group here?
First of all, I'm sort of bemused that I could be appointed a founding member of a new political formation without attending any boring organizational meetings. So that's convenient. So I'm thankful for that. I don't know. I think you know, there's so no real unifying trait that you could discern that all of these people really even share. Maybe. Beyond maybe just that they were very critical of Hillary Clinton during the Democratic
campaign. I think there is that. There is opposition to establishment liberalism, which, you know, I think has made it, has been not entirely unrelated to your position on the Russia thing, right? Right. I mean, so...
Because she was a progenitor of much of the Russia hysteria. I mean, she made that a main theme of her campaign.
Right. And I mean, there's a separate thing, which is I think you know, she is she's a hawk on foreign policy, and I have to say that, you know, I'm not, and so I'm a liberal who isn't all that happy when she sounds really hawkish, and there was a certain hawkish tone to the whole mainstream liberal reaction to the Russia thing and so on. So I guess that makes sense. So in other words, left of Hillary, you know, left of the liberal establishment is one thing many of these people have in common, right? Certainly not Mickey Kaus, but many of these other people, right?
Yeah, I would say so. It's sort of weird to me that, you know, being critical of the liberal establishment could alone be basis to group people together who otherwise have very little in common. So sort of kind of, you know, weaving, grouping together very disparate people on a flimsy commonality that they just happen to share seems a little weird. And affixing the, you know, the prefix of alt obviously is meant to be evocative of the so-called alt-right, and therefore maybe implies some level of equivalence there, which I think is what a lot of people objected to about the piece. You know, there were people on the left who I saw reacting to the piece who were just outraged that I would even be included in any such alt-left formation because they don't view me as a member in good standing of any left at all. So the idea that I would be a flagship member of this thing is a little weird. But
what do they cite as the evidence that you're not a proper leftist, aside from not seeming to be on their team in this particular the Russia thing?
As far as I can tell, they don't cite much evidence. I mean, that's just a recurring frustration.
I mean, were you?
Were you? It's just this imputation of sort of apostasy, without really citing anything tangible. And I don't know. I think, you know, Freddie DeBoer is somebody who, you know, I've read for years and who has been very critical of liberal orthodoxies. Mm-hmm. He was critical of the Hillary campaign, Clinton campaign. But, you know, if you put him and I in a room, I'm sure we could find a million things that we parted ways on pretty vigorously. So just this whole instinct to sort of assign a group label to somebody as an act, to a group as an act of derision, rather than anything born of actual analysis, to me is where this piece sort of floundered. So he was doing it as just to hurl a collective insult, rather than to actually probe what commonality these people legitimately have and whether they can be construed as any sort of, you know, recognizable political grouping.
Well, so were you a Bernie supporter? Just to locate.
Yeah, I was. I voted for Bernie Sanders. Yeah.
So, in terms of anything else he says that could be taken as analysis as opposed to insult, he says, in fact, in the kind of subhead of the piece, it says, much of the media spotlight has been on the alt-right, but the alt-left provides a mirror image distortion, the same loathing of Clinton, a rejection of identity politics, and itch for a reckoning. I guess by itch for reckoning, he means you want to get back, I guess, at the Democratic establishment. But I don't know. I mean, Hillary's kind of dead. I don't know what exactly you'd be agitating for at this point. But the rejection of identity politics is interesting because I haven't heard it from you, but I've heard it from Freddie DeBoer. At least I've heard this form of it, which is that the left has gotten, and in retrospect, this was probably prescient because I recall him saying on Blogging Heads well before the election, I think, the left has gotten obsessed with identity politics, not just I don't know if he mentioned or even necessarily meant Black Lives Matter, but I know he wasn't only talking about ethnic identity politics. He was also talking about gender identity politics. And he was saying that they've forgotten, like, the basic mission of the left is supposed to be about the downtrodden, you know, low-income people, jobless people, and so on in general. And in retrospect, if you had taken that to heart, you might have been in a better position to oppose Donald Trump because he wound up picking up former, you know, members of the Democratic constituency who didn't feel they were being served by the Democrats. But in any event, I think that was part of Freddie's critique of identity politics. Have you been in this? Have you gotten into identity politics at all?
Definitely not as full-throatedly as Freddie, but I agree with much of his critique there. I think this hyper-emphasis on identity allowed certain Democratic influencers or high-level kind of pundits and operators to advance a very superficial form of politics that ended up crippling Hillary in a lot of ways. So I don't know if you remember this moment from during the primary campaign where Hillary, the official quote-unquote Hillary Clinton Twitter account, tweeted out this chart having to do with intersectionality. And it was a really, a convoluted just flowchart representation that, you know, maybe some, you know, second-year student at Brown might have thought was exceptionally persuasive. But the wider public really had no inkling of what that was supposed to mean. So, you know, to the extent that I have a criticism there, it's of this emphasis on identity issues as a replacement for a more thoroughgoing political program. I'm not opposed on principle to identity groups forging, self-contained, coming up with interests that represent them as a group necessarily. But it's just kind of morphed into this artificial kind of sloganeering that I think a lot of people tend to be disillusioned by. But again, you know, this is not something that I've spent a whole lot of time talking about. I guess just by inference, I'm associated with people who would level that mode of critique. But it's not a huge focus of my work necessarily. For some reason, the perception of people looking in is that, I don't know, anybody in this kind of hazily defined cohort must be all about that, which is, a little weird.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, another name that Walcott draws into the alt-left is Cornel West. Last time I checked, Cornel West was not adamantly opposed to identity politics. So
yeah, or at the very least, I mean, he would have... I think he would be adamantly opposed to the appropriation of identity politics by establishment liberals who just want to sort of dangle it over the heads of voters and get them on board, without any kind of accompanying political program that he would see as sufficiently, robust or sufficiently challenging to establishment norms.
No, that's a good point. He was not a Hillary supporter. He was initially a Bernie supporter and then a Jill Stein supporter.
I think a lot of what this just boils down to is just this kind of lingering resentment for anybody who wasn't full-throatedly in favor of Hillary Clinton, for people who kind of tried to probe the inconsistencies in establishment liberalism, and who are seen by people like Walcott as being direct enablers of the election of Trump, even though nobody mentioned in that group of people advocated for anybody to vote for Trump. They were simply saying that these orthodoxies underlying the Clinton campaign kind of paved the way for Trump. And we're not just going to fall in line like some kind of dutiful, stooge.
Yeah. Now, Mickey Kaus actually did wind up voting for Trump and is a Trump supporter. Okay. But as we've said, he's the most, conspicuously, what's wrong with this picture name here? If you were really going to try to do some kind of cogent definition of the alt-left, he wouldn't be there. I think you're right. I mean, Walcott, it's basically, look, we live in tribal times. I am tremendously alarmed by Donald Trump. And the thing that Walcott says at the end, look, these leftists are warning us about the deep state. As it's exercising its power in the context of this Russia controversy. And he says, well, if the deep state can bring Trump down, I'm for the deep state or something. He says something like that. And, look, I got to say, notwithstanding what I've said, if the Russian thing keeps Trump from getting reelected or something, I'm not going to spend a lot of time in mourning. I mean, so I identify with my level of alarm about Trump, ranks pretty high. But at the same time, I think Walcott is crazy.
Yeah. And it's just, that's why, it's not any kind of actual good faith political analysis, in my judgment. It's just sort of a hasty little barb that he saw fit to throw, because for one thing, if he really did want to coin or identify an emerging political formation, maybe he would have interviewed some of the people mentioned in the piece, which he did not, as far as I know, or at least nobody contacted me. And I think for example, Mark Ames and Glenn Greenwald have had a running feud that dates back many years now, so I think they would be amused to find themselves classified as allies all of a sudden, just because they've expressed concern about forces in the federal government working to subvert the will of the polity. Mm-hmm. I think if you have to belong to some kind of new political cohort to advance that concern, then I don't know. Something has gone haywire, because that seems pretty straightforward and pretty warranting of alarm, no matter how you feel about Trump per se. I mean, it's just not beyond dispute at this point that the reason, say, Mike Flynn was forced to resign is because his phone communications were intercepted by deep state actors and selectively leaked to the media. I mean, so it's not hard to imagine how, if that were applied to somebody who you look favorably upon, on a journalist or a pundit or maybe even a liberal politician, people would be, you know, going berserk. The precedent that sets, to me, you don't have to, you know, be a member of all anything to raise questions about the propriety of that. But it seems like so many people are so motivated, you know, monomaniacally by doing whatever it takes to undermine Trump, that they have no patience for criticism along the lines of, hey, yeah, this might undermine Trump in the very short term, but in the medium or longer term, it could have implications that maybe we don't want to set a precedent for in a functioning democracy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that point of view isn't inherently alt anything. It's, for me, it's alt rationality, or maybe just rationality.
And I think Glenn Greenwald has been particularly good in being very explicit about the principles at stake here. So, you know, there are fairly elaborate versions of this argument there. I mean, the funny thing, as for Flynn, is that what he is alleged to have originally done is, to my mind, not at all surprising and not very alarming. I mean, you would just expect, in general, major powers, when there's about to be a transition of power, to start getting in touch with the administration and working things out. I mean, that's just not... there have certainly been worse versions of that. I mean, what Henry Kissinger is alleged to have done in basically sabotaging peace talks, LBJ peace initiative, so that Nixon could be elected, that's really disturbing. This is not qualitatively, I think, like that.
Any contacts at all between, you know, merely being in communication with a Russian official is now taken by the establishment and by many liberals as inherently sinister, or as just inherently something that should be construed as indicative of nefarious intent. And I know people like Mark Ames, who, you know, who lived in Russia and was very critical of Putin, for example, while he was in Russia, is now saying, hey, you know, this has kind of gone off the rails. And really, it's grounded in something that resembles a Russophobia, or which is a xenophobic impulse, but it's being fostered for political opportunism, for reasons of political opportunism. And I don't think, you know, I don't think trying to counteract that means that you're a member of any kind of, you know, fledgling political formation, you know, notwithstanding what James Walcott might want to have people believe.
Now, in terms of how much blowback you've gotten, do you attribute any of this to, like, the structure of Twitter? I mean, the thing about Twitter, and the reason, you know, I tweet, but I rarely, there are all kinds of opinions I have that I think would be controversial, and I just say Twitter is not the place for these, because you spell them out in increments, and each increment has an independent life, and so, you know, it gets one thing you say will get retweeted, and the qualification you make in the subsequent tweet will not reach the same audience. So it's problematic. And I actually wrote a piece for Slate once about what I think Twitter should do to solve that problem. But as is so often the case, my advice goes unheeded. But what do you think about the is Twitter part of your problem?
I don't know that I would even call it a problem. I sort of call it a I don't know what to call it, but to me it doesn't seem very problematic, because whenever I talk to somebody who has been a longstanding critic of mine, we almost invariably come to sort of an understanding whereby, you know, they tend to recognize that the overheated depictions of me that they've come across, you know, on Twitter don't seem necessarily reflective of reality. But yeah, I think it has to do with, you know, the Twitter has to be the single most the single most determinative progenitor of groupthink in human history, because you receive social approbation immediately when you put something out. You can see exactly who is giving you the approbation, and you can see when you receive denunciation. And there's no time in between to ponder things. And within Twitter, certain subgroups emerge that become a culture unto themselves. So when you know, a meme develops, it's almost impossible to uproot the meme. Because, you know, if you question the veracity of the meme, say, you know, Michael Tracy bad or whatever, that means you're sort of going against the orthodoxy of your subcultural group, and you don't want to necessarily expend that social capital on defending somebody who seems to have been ostracized by people who you trust. So yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with the peculiarities of Twitter. On the other hand, you know, Twitter can also be a hugely useful tool and can bring together like-minded people. So I don't necessarily have attributed to Twitter as a how to phrase it. I don't necessarily condemn Twitter as a platform because people have used it to misconstrue things I've said frequently. I just take it to be, I just, you know, accept it as reality and do what I can to just calmly rebut what I think are falsehoods.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. I guess that's...
Can I just ask you, do you think there is any... I'm curious to know what you would say as an observer, right? I mean, do you think there is any legitimacy to the criticisms that have been leveled against me to the extent that you've been privy to them?
Well, the Russia thing, I mean, I've talked about. I basically, my initial reaction at the very beginning when they started trying to use the Russia thing during the Hillary campaign in a big way against Trump, and I remember, you know, people like Frank Foer and Josh Marshall were saying, why are people ignoring this? Which, in the end, they really didn't. But I thought, well, if you want to know why I'm ignoring it, is I just aversively, I react aversively to things that smell like xenophobia. In general, trying to, you know, tar people by virtue of association with sinister foreign powers just sets off alarm bell. You know, I wrote my senior thesis in college on McCarthyism, and or at least on McCarthy's relationship to Eisenhower. And so I'm largely on your wavelength there. Now, I will say that... you know, I'm probably by nature a more cautious person than you are. You know, when I see you tweeting, I see individual tweets, and I think, well, someone might see this tweet and think this guy's a Trump supporter, even though you never say that. But partly because we live in tribal times when everyone seems to be either ardently, you know, anti-Trump or pro-Trump. I wouldn't do things exactly the way you do them. I mean, maybe I should ask you about one other thing, which is an example of the way Twitter, I think, may complicate communication. So I didn't see your original tweet, but I saw your qualification. This was about whether the anti-Semitism, the stories about a resurgence of anti-Semitism or an upsurge in anti-Semitism are overblown. And I assume your original tweet had suggested you thought that they in some sense were, but the qualification, which I think was, what was it on? It wasn't on Medium, but anyway, it was a qualification that took longer than it consumed more space than an individual tweet would have consumed, provided some context for what you'd said. So maybe you should tell me like what you said and what you meant.
Yeah. I did tweet about that. I think you're right that you do have to have a certain temperament to want to put things out there into the universe that you know are probably going to bring forth pretty overheated pushback. Right. I mean, it's not, and I wouldn't begrudge anybody who doesn't see that as a useful use of their time. I've always been somebody who is, you know, eager to debate and just be engaged in a back and forth, you know, almost all the time. So I know not everybody is of that same disposition. As to the anti-Semitism thing, yeah, I did say something that caused a huge uproar. And I think it was totally justifiable. I think the thing is, people were primed to say, oh, look, this is more evidence of this guy just trying to excuse Trump, when it's just not that. I mean, I couldn't be more clear that is not my intent. Mm-hmm. I mean, unless you just think that I'm lying or that I'm willfully attempting to deceive people as to my true intent, then I mean there's no justifiable reasons to impute that motivation to me. What I was simply saying was that there were a rash of cemetery desecrations and bomb threats called in on one particular week, and then this was kind of exploded into a national news media narrative that everybody was paying attention to. Trump was asked about it at one point, and eventually did give some sort of condemnation of anti-Semitism. But people were saying, "Oh, Trump didn't do this willingly enough." And that seems like maybe he's just tacitly, or maybe even not so tacitly, giving license to anti-Semites who comprise some segment of his base.
Well, also, there was his out-and-out bizarre reaction to the reporter who asked about it at the press conference, and that, I think, fueled speculation. That was pretty strange. We don't need to get into that, but I'm sure you remember what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I remember that. And Trump is not always very tactful about how he handles things. No. There's no doubt about that.
Or why.
My point was simply, okay, so number one, we as yet have no information whatsoever about the identity, motives, or nature of the perpetrators of these acts. Now, before trying to make this into a grand narrative, shouldn't we at least have some basic information about who did these things? Whether they do represent a genuine uptick as compared to, say, February 2016 or February 2007. It just seems people were so ready to just declare the onset of this new narrative that, to me, that wasn't justified. And here's what most bothered me about it, and this is what people didn't comment on because it didn't align with their conception of where I was coming from. To me, there was this implied parity that people were asserting between anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. And Islamophobia, I think it's undeniable that it has an institutional basis. There's institutionalized Islamophobia in the United States. Politicians campaign explicitly trying to foster Islamophobic sentiment. The current president did that all throughout the 2016 campaign. There are actual the United States has been at war with predominantly Muslim countries for 15 years. Muslims have been surveilled. So there are tangible things that you can point to as evidence for institutionalized Islamophobic sentiment in the United States. But there's just nothing remotely comparable in terms of institutionalized anti-Semitism. So the idea that one cemetery desecration combined with a couple bomb threats called into Jewish centers somehow elevates anti-Semitism to being of equal concern with Islamophobia, to me, I think was just totally unwarranted. And it seems like a lot of people were jumping to that conclusion based on a pretty anecdotal set of data. Whereas you don't need anecdotes to be pretty convinced that there's institutionalized Islamophobia in the United States.
They're different. I mean, I think given where Trump seems to come from ideologically, his association with various people, both are legitimate sources of concern. And if I were Jewish, I'd be pretty freaked out by, something like a cemetery desecration. It's different from a bomb threat. I mean, you really got to work to go start pushing over tombstones and take some personal risk. So I would find that, I find it somewhat alarming.
Thing is, cemetery desecrations are a pretty routine occurrence in the United States.
Well, okay, so you're suggesting that maybe there was actually no actual uptick.
I think that remains to be seen. Mm-hmm. I'm willing to grant that there could be, say, a 3% uptick this year compared to 2016, and that would be cause for concern. Would it warrant this explosion of a new narrative saying, with that posits anti-Semitism being surging in the United States? I'm a little doubtful of that. Mm-hmm. Just a week after the spate of bomb threats, we learned that some of them were called in by this seemingly left-wing reporter that used to formerly work for The Intercept and was fired for fabricating. And other bomb threats were called in by what the FBI believes are foreign actors. So, you know, I'm willing to accept that there might be a guy in his basement in, you know, Arkansas somewhere making these calls. But I just think, you know, there was this rush to judgment and this rush to construct narratives is something that liberals have been very very leery of in the past. But they're giving into that temptation just so mindlessly now because it seems to reflect badly on Trump, and that's their overriding motivation for everything, you know, making Trump look as bad as possible.
Yeah, I guess I was going to what I was going to say was I don't see it. I mean, I think, again, given Trumpism, a number of things are worth keeping a very close eye on. Anti-Semitism, bigotry toward, you know, Latinos or undocumented workers, Islamophobia, and so on. My it isn't so much that I feel the anti-Semitism is being overplayed. It's that I think the Islamophobia is being underplayed relative to it. And the reason is that, well, part of it is related to what you said. I mean, in institutional terms, I don't know exactly what you meant by the institutional sources of Islamophobia. I think there are actually probably some think tanks that have done a little to contribute to it. But one institution that could well, you know, continue, you know, foment Islamophobia and even take action against Muslims as a group is the U.S. government so long as Trump is president. Now, that's not going to happen with Jews. I think now.
Right.
Now, it's still anti-Semitism. Populist anti-Semitism is a scary thing, and I think given the kinds of where some of Trump's support comes from, it is right to demand that he step in and denounce these things clearly, which he has not seemed to be eager to do. But I also think what troubles me is there have been relatively few demands that he step in and denounce Islamophobia. I mean, you know, when you look at where bullets have actually flown, right, the Indian immigrant who was killed in Kansas and a Sikh who was shot just this weekend but not killed, I think it's safe to say in both cases those guys thought they were shooting at Muslims. The guy who killed the Indian apparently thought the guy was Iranian for whatever reason. And, of course, Sikhs are commonly mistaken for Muslims by people who don't realize that actually your average male Muslim does not wear a turban, right? But many Sikhs do. So I think what bothers me is, I mean, I think like the question that so freaked Trump out at that press conference for unclear reasons about anti-Semitism was perfectly legit. I just think it should always be paired with a question about Islamophobia and, for that matter, bigotry more generally of the kind that I think Trump may be empowering, you know, actually mobilized violent bigotry.
Yeah, I just think it's so crucial to note that whatever anti-Semitism does exist in the United States, it's not manifesting in terms of actual government policy.
Right.
Or at least not yet. And it seems highly unlikely.
And I don't think it will be under Trump. I really don't. I agree with that part.
But you don't have to do much work at all to find examples of Islamophobic sentiment manifesting in the United States, having to do with the Trump travel ban. I would even argue having to do with the eight predominantly Muslim countries that Obama bombed during his term, you know, having to do with the Iraq War. I mean, so these are so the implied parity between the two is what really I found bothersome. And the other thing is, and I saw a really good post about this on Facebook that I decided not to share on Twitter because I decided to exercise some restraint, and because I knew I would spend whenever I comment on this, I'd have to spend like a full day rebutting, you know, the most vicious possible accusations that people could level. But there was a former staffer for one of the Bernie Sanders grassroots organizations who said something to the effect of, you know, by making such an issue out of these supposed anti-Semites on the rise, you're almost kind of like elevating them and you're giving them more credence as a, you know, a formidable political faction than they really deserve. So why get bogged down in that? I mean, why unduly elevate people who otherwise are and will probably remain very, very marginal actors?
Yeah, I suppose there's always that danger that they'll take it as positive feedback. Like when that white nationalist Spencer, like when two Heil Hitler salutes and suddenly he's globally famous, you know, I wondered if that, you know, if that wasn't, I mean, if you remember when people in his audience did that and that was so widely publicized, I thought, you know, I think these guys can, what's that?
And there were reporters at that event.
Yeah. I mean, I think that.
And there were more reporters at that event than actual supporters.
Right. I mean, there really were, I think you only saw maybe 3-4 arms raised. And I wondered at the time, do these guys consider that positive reinforcement? I think in retrospect, they may not, given the way it's played out for Spencer, because he's been kind of marginalized even within the alt-right, which I think was not his aspiration. But in any event, so we've gone on longer than usual, but I wanted to get clear on whether you are or are not a member of the alt-left.
I will neither confirm nor deny that.
Okay. Well, that's your right. Yeah, you're right, but don't expect to ever work in this town again. And in fact, you are in that town. You are in Southern California now.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
well,
I don't need their approval at this point, but maybe later I'll disavow it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you can keep that option open. Well, thank you. And people can see your work on Young Turks. Anywhere else they should look?
Everything goes on Twitter. I mean, maybe if you don't already have a Medium account, all the cool kids do. So make one of those, and you can follow me there, and you can follow the Young Turks and all that good stuff.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So thank you, Michael Tracy. And down the road, after you've generated some more controversy, you'll have to check in again.
Okay. Looking forward to it.
Okay. See ya.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.